It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the latest in national political news with Paul Singer from USA Today.
First, rising student loan debt has gotten a lot of attention all around the country. But according to a new series from the USA Today network called Degrees of Debt, it's particularly bad here in Wisconsin.
The series goes beyond the struggle to pay back loans. It also looks at what the big price tags on higher education mean for college access and how young people are doing in the job market.
Joining us now is Rory Linane, reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Her essay on student debt in Wisconsin kicked off the series. Rory, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Jim Fitzhenry. He's editor of the Degrees of Debt series. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Well, let's start, Rory, with a person you profile in this opening essay, Lamont Williams. Can you tell us a little about his story?
Yeah, Lamont Moore. He grew up in Milwaukee around 5th and Chambers, which is an area dealing with a lot of poverty and violence. And his mom worked really hard to move his family up to Mequon. And it kind of seems like, you know, from hearing the story, they made all the right moves. They did everything they could to get him the best education possible, and he got good grades. He was a star athlete on the basketball team, and so the story looks at, you know, why now, 6 years later, is Lamont $15,000 in debt and still doesn't have a college degree after all that.
And you write that the college debt problem is affecting people in all classes, but it's an especially big problem for people from lower income groups trying to get into college, and I guess more importantly, trying to pay for it.
Yeah, they face the most barriers in trying to pay for it and trying to get loans that they can ultimately pay back. Although the problem is growing, and now even for middle and upper class students, it's becoming increasingly difficult to afford college.
We'll go more into Rory's essay, but Jim, can you talk a little bit about the Degrees of Debt series more generally? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, what we really want to do is bring the issue to light that so many families are dealing with, especially this time of year when kids are returning to campus and people have conversations around their kitchen tables about how are we going to pay for this, how are we going to pay for that. We're going to take a very thorough and serious look at the issue and then try and spark some conversations with communities about how do we start to address this problem and tackle it in a way that is beyond simply like one biennium budget or beyond one campaign cycle, but long-term systemically really start to get our arms around the problem.
And you're including essays like Rory's that are not just the standard statistics and politicians weighing in. Why are you tackling it this way?
I think because when people read about real people doing things and when they get beyond the conventional things, that it gives them a way to connect with something, to identify with it, to humanize it, and then to begin to discuss it in a way that really gets people to drop some of their, sometimes their hostility about talking about issues like this and get them into a mode where they really begin to discuss solutions to problems.
Talking to Jim Fitzhenry and Rory Linane, they're both with USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at an ongoing series, Degrees of Debt. It just started off with Rory's essay looking at student loan debt here in Wisconsin. Rory, in your piece, the first one in this series, you look at disparities. We started to touch on that a little. Can you talk a little bit about the disparities in college attendance in, say, the Milwaukee area and in debt?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked specifically at the Milwaukee area since that's where Lamont is from and since I grew up in that area also, and so it's interesting to look at the diverging paths that can happen in that area depending in large part on your race and your family's income. And so in recent years we've seen that white students have been attending college more and more often as black students have been attending college less often, and so those gaps are continuing to grow. And according to one analysis, Wisconsin has the second widest gap in the country when you compare how often white and black residents have college degrees.
President Obama has called a college degree a ticket to the middle class. We just heard about a report of the State of Working Wisconsin yesterday. There's about a $10 an hour bonus for completing that college degree. So are people finding themselves able, especially those people in, say, Milwaukee, able to get that college degree?
Oftentimes not. It's sometimes the price tag of college is enough to give people sticker shock, and they just think there's no way that they'll be able to make that happen. Or also in the case of Lamont's story, a guidance counselor didn't really reach out to him about college until 3 months before he graduated, and so it wasn't on his radar as early as it should have been in order for him to get in applications and have a good array of schools to choose from and have good financial aid packages to choose from. So part of it is the K-12 system needing to really prepare students for college better, and part of it is helping students be able to actually afford it.
And Rory, you kind of compared and contrasted your own life story with Lamont's as examples of two mm-hmm. different paths people follow. Can you spell that out for us a little?
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in Shorewood, which is a wealthier suburb northeast of the city. And so there, from the high school that I went to, I had a scholarship from my high school that paid for a good chunk of college for me. And so, it was really kind of our geography, our race, our families that separated where Lamont and I started in life, and from there it really traced the trajectories of our life, where I went on and did a pretty traditional college path and graduated free of debt and able to take different risks with my career, such as becoming a print journalist. Lamont has been more weighed down by the student debt and unable to graduate yet at this point.
Jim, as this series, Degrees of Debt, continues, who all are you trying to bring in the conversation here about student debt in Wisconsin?
Well, we're going to start on college campuses, and we're going to be having some conversations there with students and faculty and community members. And then we want to extend the conversation to parents and families in high school and middle school, as they're starting the discovery process of thinking about, okay, I have a student in middle school, what should we be thinking about as a family as far as preparing for saving money, preparing for thinking about careers and college options? So we really want to have a really broad base of the community participate, add their voices to this, and really see if we can put together some concrete recommendations about how to address the problem.
Right. On other series that that you all have done, you've brought together town halls of people, ordinary people in government, and experts, things like that. Is that part of what you're working on here?
Yeah, definitely. We're going to be kicking off on September 20th. Our first what we're calling Degree of Debt rally is going to be at Lawrence University in Appleton. And we're really hoping to get a great cross-section of the community and students on campus to hear from them directly about what are the things that they're experiencing. But we're also going to have people from the university on our discussion panel. We're going to have some young professionals talking about their journey from graduating college, dealing with their own finances and the workforce, and to try and bring people together and have that conversation about how do we solve the problem, what can we hear and learn from each other, and what are the next steps.
And before we wrap up, Roy, what is your next step? What are you working on next in this series?
We have a lot coming up. We're going to be looking at specifically issues that students face at community colleges and for-profit colleges. And we'll be looking at politicians' plans for addressing student debt and some of the kind of pitfalls of private loans and what other states are doing to address this issue.
Rory, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Jim, thanks to you as well.
Thanks as always. Love to be on the show.
That was Rory Linane, reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, and Jim Fitzhenry, an editor at USA Today Network Wisconsin. They talked to us about high levels of college debt and how it affects students and families in Wisconsin. The story was part of a new series that the paper launched called Degrees of Debt.
Right now, we check in on the latest news in national politics. A Dallas newspaper endorsed Hillary Clinton for president, the first time the paper has endorsed a Democrat in 75 years.
President Obama canceled a diplomatic meeting with the president of the Philippines following some inflammatory language from the Filipino leader. And Donald Trump is trying to distance himself from a donation he made to Florida's attorney general.
Joining us now to talk about these stories and more is Paul Singer. He's the Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Well, let's start with the numbers. Where is the polling for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton today?
Oh, you know, it depends on where you look, of course. We have just actually launched a poll tracking device at USA Today that tracks these trends over time. There was a nice poll for Donald Trump today from CNN indicating that he has a lead for the first time in a while, but you know, with all these polls, everything is simply a snapshot in time. I'm a little more enthusiastic about sort of watching the trends over time, because if you compile all this data into averages, you get a little bit better view of the whole thing. It looks like Clinton has still been in the lead nationally for, you know, most of the campaign season by, you know, a handful of points. But Trump has been trending up recently as he's been getting his feet under him with more sort of policy-heavy speeches, and Hillary Clinton's email scandals have continued to plague her. So, you know, race is still close. It's still a serious presidential campaign. Again, pick a state. You know, remember, we don't actually vote on a national basis. We vote state by state, so that's where it's really going to matter.
And any idea where Wisconsin is standing? I think I saw a Washington Post poll earlier this week saying that Wisconsin was now considered a toss-up in that polling.
Wisconsin has been pretty close off and on. I mean, it's an interesting thing about Wisconsin, of course, is that you guys have a state race that is interesting, that is a Senate race that is interesting, that is still driving people to the polls. At the moment, you know, on average, Clinton has been ahead by 3 or 4 points over the past few months. It is now closer. It looks like she's only up by a point or so in the most recent round of polling. But again, all of these are snapshots at any given time. Let's see, you know, as it trends, does Donald Trump really pull out a victory in Wisconsin? Does he affect the Senate race between Feingold and Johnson, or vice versa? Does the Feingold-Johnson race affect the top of the ticket? We will have to see how that all shakes out. At the moment, it's still close enough to watch.
So those are the two front runners. What about third-party challengers like Jill Stein from the Green Party and Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson? How are they looking?
Well, we count them. We include them in our polling. We've also just launched some Facebook tracker. We track their activity as well, but they're tiny. They're getting 6.67% is for Johnson. Well, Wisconsin, let's see, 6.7% for Johnson, 3% for Stein. Nationally, about the same. Johnson hangs at around 7 or 8%. Stein hangs around 3%. You know, enough to conceivably tip a state or two one way or the other if they're taking support from one of the other major candidates, but not enough to win a state, and I think more importantly, not enough to reach the 15% threshold in the national polls to get on the debate stage, which is really sort of the do-or-die moment for any third party.
And so speaking of Facebook, you wrote a piece about the appeal of Gary Johnson for younger people on Facebook. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, it's interesting that, as I said, we've built this sort of Facebook tracker to watch conversations on Facebook about the candidates. And again, you know, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump generate tens of millions of posts or likes or comments every week. Gary Johnson, you know, generates maybe 3 million, you know, maybe 10% of what Hillary Clinton is generating. But the people who are engaged in that conversation on Facebook about Gary Johnson tend to be much younger than the people who are engaged in the conversation about Hillary Clinton. That is, the percentages are just off the charts. I mean, he's getting 25 or 30% of his conversation is from people who are under the age of 35. Whereas for Hillary Clinton, it's just the opposite. You know, she's got, you know, maybe 15 or 20% of the conversation is coming from that group, whereas the higher percentage, 35%, is coming from people over the age of 50. So it's really interesting. You see some of the demographics of the campaign in the conversation on Facebook.
Now let's look at an endorsement new out this morning. The Dallas Morning News, breaking with tradition, endorsing Hillary Clinton for president. And this is big news in another sense. They haven't done this, picked a Democrat in 75 years. What did the paper have to say about why they were choosing to do that, picking Clinton over Donald Trump?
Yeah, well, in a sense, what they, I mean, again, this just explains, shows how upside down this whole election is. I mean, they basically said Clinton's the only real candidate in the race, that they couldn't bring themselves to endorse Trump. They couldn't bring themselves to endorse Stein. They couldn't bring themselves to endorse Johnson. Clinton, they said, at least has experience. She's credible. She's reasonable and reliable. And they don't like the Democratic platform by and large. But given the alternatives, she was the only one they said is a realistic choice for president. So they just kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, you know, hey, what else can we say? This is the only candidate we think has actual credibility and the strength in the resume to be president. But for the Dallas Morning News, which hasn't endorsed a Democrat since before World War II, in the middle of Texas, one of the reddest states in the country, it's just, it's wacky.
And I noticed that they said, it seemed like careful wording at the end of the endorsement, saying that Hillary Clinton was the right person for the job at this particular point in time, I guess leaving space for things to unfold maybe differently.
Right. You know, it's only Wednesday. We'll be back with another endorsement on Friday. I don't know. Again, we are watching this race unfold with just a – you start with two candidates who are not very popular at all. And then you have the normal sort of late cycle, one scandal after another. This is when the stories break. This is when the so-called October surprise begins to emerge. You know, it just is going to add to their unpopularity, be a race to the bottom. Maybe the one who is, you know, liked by 10% of the people might be enough to win by the end of this election cycle.
We're talking national politics right now with Paul Singer from USA Today. And Paul, I have to ask you, do you think, you work at a newspaper who does a lot more than just print stuff, but do newspaper endorsements still matter?
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't. In fact, I've long crusaded against newspapers having editorial opinions at all. You know, in a lower tiered race, if you were talking about a county commissioner race, then the newspaper endorsement might mean something because the readers probably have not been exposed to the candidates, don't know much about the candidates, and are looking for guidance from people who've done some research. On a presidential poll, a presidential race, who doesn't know enough about Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump to make their minds up without the assistance of the Dallas Morning News? I mean, what does the Dallas Morning News know that their reader doesn't know? I got no idea. But it makes a story. You know, we'll click on it and people will talk about it.
And looking now at the Trump campaign, Trump is deflecting criticism. News broke that he spoke with Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi before writing her a $25,000 check to run for re-election in 2013. What is the story there, Paul?
The problem, there's a couple problems with this whole scenario. Basically, Biondi was in this position of considering, along with other attorneys general, whether to join a suit against Trump's university, which has been accused in some cases of fraudulent practices. So she declined to get involved. So Florida Attorney General did not join this suit. It is right around that time that Trump's foundation gave her a $25,000 donation for her reelection. Now, the foundation is not allowed to make political donations. So the Trump campaign says, well, there was a mistake, it was accidental, it was supposed to be his own money, it was something. And they ended up paying an IRS fine of $2,500 because they clearly violated the rules here. Trump is saying there was nothing to it. The fact that she did not pursue the investigation had nothing to do with the donation, doesn't remember actually discussing it with her. The problem for Trump, of course, is that he spent 6 months or so during the campaign saying, well, I used to buy and sell favors from politicians with donations. So his own previous explanation of his sort of political involvement would give a hint that maybe there was some kind of a deal here. But they say there is no deal. We obviously can't prove there was any kind of a deal. It just looks really funny.
And Trump's campaign manager spoke with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, was questioned about that contribution, and here's what she had to say.
In the case of Mr. Trump and Attorney General Biondi, they both said that they'd never discussed the Trump University lawsuit. Mr. Trump,
but they did
given,
talk on the phone in the, at that time period.
They may have talked about anything. He has a residence in Florida, and
she asked for a contribution
to her for her reelection. He has supported many, many Republican candidates.
And so there's a reaction there from Trump's campaign manager. And Paul, do you think that this issue in particular is one that could cause trouble for Donald Trump, or is
sure. I mean, again, part of the question for Trump, I think, is less this specific donation, which is, you know, pretty much on the table already. There is an ongoing question about how he used his foundation money. I mean, at one point, somebody discovered that he had bought a football helmet at a charity auction using foundation money. It frequently looks like he doesn't really separate the foundation's money from his own money, and that can be a real problem, a real legal problem of mixing pots of money that are supposed to be for specific purposes. And by the way, this is one of the issues with his tax returns, is that we would like to see the tax returns to make sure it is clear what he made charitable donations with his own money, where he was using other people's money. That stuff becomes a real question for him. And it's again, it just makes it harder for him to praise the case that Hillary Clinton's foundation is a problem.
And Paul, before we let you go, what's on your radar as you watch the campaign unfold over the next several weeks?
Well, we're going to have a town hall tonight, I guess on NBC, which will be sort of interesting to watch. But we're all really just sort of digging in for the first debate. The first opportunity for them to stand face-to-face September, what is it, 25th or 26th, I think, in Long Island, New York. This will be, I think, the major turning point of this campaign. You know, it's an opportunity for Donald Trump to prove that he belongs there next to Hillary Clinton, and an opportunity for her to prove that she can withstand what could be a fairly furious range of attacks from Trump.
All right, Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Talk to you soon, Veronica.
That was Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today, and he joined us there talking about the latest in national political news.
This week is Suicide Prevention Awareness Week. Here in Wisconsin, 755 people died by suicide in 2014, 4.5 times the number of people who died by homicide that year. About one person under the age of 20 dies by suicide each week in Wisconsin.
As part of Suicide Prevention Awareness Week, advocates are highlighting the role of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and other resources.
Shel Gross joins us now to talk about Suicide Prevention Awareness Week. He's Director of Public Policy for Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Shel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. Glad to be here.
Now, Shel, before we get into the wider issue of suicide prevention, right off the bat, for people out there who might be dealing with this themselves, someone in their family, what kind of resources are out there for them to reach out to?
Well, as you mentioned, and I appreciate you doing so, National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK, is available 24/7. And many of those calls are actually answered from crisis centers in Wisconsin. So that's certainly a resource for people. Every county also has a crisis response capability. So people can go, if they want, on our website, PreventSuicideWisconsin.org, and click on their county, and they can find the crisis number for their county. And that's sort of the most immediate thing people can do.
Now, Shel, we mentioned some of the most recently available statistics on suicide in Wisconsin, but big picture, how big of a problem is suicide for us here in the state?
Well, 755, that's a big number. Wisconsin, in 2014, just snuck below the national average, but we've generally run above that. But you add to that, that's the number of people who died by suicide. There are many, many other people who made attempts, needed medical care. And then for those people who die by suicide, family and friends are impacted, sometimes in a huge way. I've seen whole communities really significantly impacted by the death of someone by suicide, especially if it's a young person.
Obviously, this is a year-round problem, but this week, this awareness week, is trying to help draw attention to it. What kind of things are you hoping come out of Suicide Prevention Awareness Week?
Yeah, and as we point out, if you go to the website, we actually have a month, 2 months worth of activities coming up, because a lot of local groups are having walks and other events all through this month and into October as well. And it's really opportunities for people locally to learn more about suicide. There are trainings so people can learn about the warning signs and how to respond. There are ways for people to get involved with some of the local coalitions that exist in many areas of our state if they're interested in, you know, working more on preventing suicides.
We're talking to Shel Gross from Mental Health America of Wisconsin, looking at Suicide Prevention Awareness Week. Shel, you at Mental Health America Wisconsin have taken on this goal. This is something that people are doing elsewhere, too. Zero suicide. Can you talk about the zero suicide effort?
Yeah, and it's something we're really excited about. One of the numbers on our press release was 43, which is the percent of people who die by suicide who are reported as being in care at the time of their death. They're seeing somebody, and we don't always know what that means. These are from coroner medical examiner reports. But we spend a lot of our efforts trying to make people aware and know how to talk to people and get them into care. We have to make sure our care systems are as effective as they can be. And over the last number of years, this Quality Improvement Initiative has developed, and it is for behavioral health and healthcare settings to really allow them to think about suicide as a never event, that when you have somebody in care, if these practices are applied conscientiously by the system, and it's not just one individual, it's the whole system, organizations have demonstrated very significant reductions in suicide. Henry Ford Health System in Detroit was one of the organizations that began work that grew into this Zero Suicide Initiative, and they reduced suicides by 80% over a four-year period, and actually went 10 quarters without a death by suicide in their system. And other organizations that are adopting these practices are starting to see similar results. So we find that very exciting, very promising in terms of our ability to reduce suicides.
And that is exciting, and it sounds like there's a mindset change almost, really thinking of suicide as something that's preventable. I think there's maybe a pop culture idea that if someone is suicidal, they'll always be suicidal. They will eventually succeed. It sounds like no, it's something that if you can get through that stretch of time, you can ultimately prevent a suicide.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It's a real culture shift as well in thinking about it. And there is pushback. Many times in health systems, some of the medical staff who have been around for a while, they're uncomfortable with the notion because they really have come to believe, you know, that's people are going to die by suicide. But what we're seeing is that doesn't have to be the result. And my perspective is that it is really creating hope in our providers, our practitioners. You know, imagine if you're a provider and you don't really believe people can get better, what are you communicating to the people you're working with? So I think it's important for providers to realize we have these tools and we have these practices that really make a difference. And I think that's where we've seen a lot of excitement in the organizations that we've been working with on this.
Well, I want to say that number again. You said at Henry Ford Hospital in Michigan, 80% decline in suicide?
They had 80% reduction, right. And they maintain that. You know, I mean, they maintain that level. One of the organizations, when we started this effort, we actually were sending teams of people to Henry Ford to get trained. Now we're actually doing these events in Wisconsin. One of the groups that went up in Wausau, North Central Healthcare, which serves public sector clients in central, north central Wisconsin, they had 7 deaths by suicide among their population the year before they went. Had 6 the year they went, although they hadn't started much, 3 the next year, and then last year they had no suicides. And they're convinced that it was these practices that have reduced that. So it really is something that is working. And it's very promising.
Now, we're talking about the medical care system right now. How about in daily life? In some of the material you put out for Prevention Week, you included some things about how to talk to someone who reveals suicidal thoughts, and maybe more importantly, how not to talk to them. Can you give us some ground rules?
Sure. I think one of the things that is available in many areas of the state, and again, if people go to the website, and if there's a coalition in their area, many of them offer training, what we call QPR, question, persuade, and refer. It's like CPR for a reason. It's sort of, you know, some of that first aid for people who may be suicidal, and it helps people understand what the warning signs are and how to talk with somebody. And I think a lot of people probably have a gut feeling that something's not right with people, and they're just afraid to ask. They're afraid to ask in part because they don't know what people to do if somebody says yes, and they're afraid to ask because they think they'll make things worse. The fact is, there's no evidence you'll make things worse. If somebody's suicidal, most cases, they will actually be relieved to have the opportunity to talk about it. So asking somebody very directly, if you're picking up clues, if they're talking about being suicidal, which is sort of the main warning sign, but if they've been in a lot of emotional distress, if there's been some significant changes in their behaviors, in their mood, they're sleeping a lot or not sleeping, or they're not doing activities they used to just ask somebody very directly, are you thinking about killing yourself? Often that can be a relief if somebody hasn't talked about that with somebody. And then, of course, in the training, you know, we would talk with people about how to then talk with that person about what their options might be, whether that be talking with their primary care doctor, going to see a therapist, talking with a clergy person that they're close to. You know, there's a lot of options, but the key thing is to keep them connected and you know, have them see somebody that they trust but who is also in a position to be able to talk with them further.
One of the ground rules, and I wonder if this one might apply to young people in particular, don't make a vow of silence. Don't keep this a secret.
Correct. Yeah. I think, you know, we always, you know, let people know that you don't want to do that. I care about you. I'm not going to keep this a secret. I want you to get help, and I'm concerned about that. The challenge with kids, as you say, is the youth culture is, you know, don't tell an adult. And the training that's available for youth is really focused on helping them understand the importance of acknowledging and caring about their friend. But part of that is finding a trusted adult to talk with.
We're talking to Shel Gross now with Mental Health America of Wisconsin, talking about Suicide Prevention Awareness Week.
And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. How has suicide touched your life? Do you have any questions about how to help a loved one with suicidal thoughts? Are you working in suicide prevention in Wisconsin? You can call in and share your story at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion about Suicide Prevention Awareness Week with Shel Gross of Mental Health America of Wisconsin.
We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about suicide and prevention efforts and resources here in Wisconsin? What do you think would help to achieve the goal we were talking about earlier of zero suicides? If you work in healthcare or mental health care, are you trained in assessing and managing suicide risk? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go right to a caller. We've got Debbie on the line in Waukesha. Debbie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to talk about, Debbie?
Well, the word successful came in with regards to suicide, and one thing I was trained in to do was to never use that word in conjunction with that, to always say a completed, because it brings a positive connotation to that act. So that was always helpful for people that are talking about it, even like on a talk show.
Mm-hmm. Debbie, thank you so much. And I'll say, as a person in the media, that is a phrase I always kind of pause and think about a little bit, the idea of a successful suicide, as Debbie says, a positive connotation. Shel, is it important, the words we use, the way we talk about suicide?
Yeah, they sure are. And kudos to Debbie for calling in about that. I think also, you know, one of the other terms we don't like to use is commit, because we talk about committing crimes and committing sins. So again, when you talk about completing suicide or dying by suicide, it's a little bit more neutral. It doesn't have that tinge to it. So that really is important to people who, you know, have lost loved ones to suicide.
Debbie, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Natalie in Eau Claire. Natalie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share some information about a local suicide prevention awareness event. It's an Out of the Darkness walk in Eau Claire, and it's coming up on September 17th. And it's part of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention organization. And I know that there are a lot of local walks. I'm more familiar with the Eau Claire one. My sister-in-law and I actually started it back in 2012 in honor of her dad who died by suicide. And it's still going strong, and the organizers are great. And it's just a really great opportunity to come, whether you have dealt with depression yourself or if you have a friend or family member who has died by suicide. So I just wanted to share that information. Again, September 17th in Eau Claire. There's information easily found online about the event, and I just really appreciate the opportunity to get the word out about it.
Natalie, thanks for calling and telling us about that Out of the Darkness walk in the Eau Claire area. And Shel, that idea, Out of the Darkness, having these public walks, I imagine that people thinking about suicide, families who have survived a suicide by a family member, it's an isolating, alienating sort of thing. Is it important just that people are out talking about this in public, having walks, things like that?
Yeah, it really is. And again, appreciate Natalie calling in. We do have that walk on our upcoming events on the website, and I see there are five other Out of Darkness walks listed. So we've got Antigo and Wausau and Elkhorn and Milwaukee and Madison. People who have lost loved ones by suicide are also at greater risk of suicide. And so making sure that they have support is really important. And you're correct, traditionally it's been very isolating. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of guilt. Families feel like they should have done something. So, it's often very helpful for people to be with others who have been in that same situation, who they know will understand what that's been like to them. And then very often, many of these groups then are doing other things. In the United States, the reason we have federal funding for suicide prevention is because of the work of those who have lost people to suicide. They have been the leaders because they know what this is about. They have, they have been there, and they don't want any other family to go through what they've been through.
We're talking to Shel Gross from Mental Health America of Wisconsin on Suicide Prevention Awareness Week. Back to your calls now with Ramel in Door County. Ramel, hi.
Hi. I lost my sister to suicide several years ago now, and I guess for people who are going through depression and this kind of thing, I think it's important for them to realize really what a rotten thing this is to do to your family. I think, my sister was a very caring, loving person, and if she would have been able to see beyond how devastating it was to her family, how hurtful it was to the people that she loved. I mean, I think she was in such a dark place. She didn't see how much harm she was doing to her children and other people, that she really did think the world would be a better place without her. And it's just such a misconception that's such a faulty line of reasoning when people are in that dark place that they can't see how devastating it is to the people around them.
Ramel, thank you so much. I'm very sorry for your loss and that you went through that. Shel, are there ways as a family member, maybe a mental health provider, to reach someone in that dark place? It may not be a place where they're considering that kind of consequence.
Right, and Ramel is correct. When somebody's in that place, they really view themselves as being a burden and really do feel like others will be better off without them. And that's a lot of what, the clinical work is about. It, is working with people on that, is understanding, what are the things that trigger them to be suicidal, what's happened in their lives, and address those things so that they can, get to a place, where they see that. But, I think we, recognize, as, Ramel does, but is not happy about that, at that particular point, her sister didn't see that. I'm reminded of a story, a woman who is herself somebody who's lived with suicidality and has made attempts. She talks about how she always believed that her family would be better off until her brother killed himself. And then she realized she didn't feel like she was better off. And it really undermined her thinking about, you know, that validity of her completing suicide, that others will be better off, because she realized that wasn't the case. But it took that for her to be aware of that. And, of course, that's not how we want people to become aware of that. But, you know, it is symptomatic of the illness for many people who are depressed or have other mental health disorders, that's, you know, that's how they're thinking at that particular time.
Ramel, thanks for calling and sharing your story. We'll go next to Dennis on the line now in Wautoma. Dennis, hi.
Hi there. I've got a quick question. A friend of mine attempted suicide recently, and it was unsuccessful, thank heaven. And, you know, he's depressed about a job situation and the money situations and other things. And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, okay, you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and so is my wife partner. And, you know, I've had some conversations with this person telling him, you know, we're both in a unique situation because we've overcome some pretty horrible situations that we put ourselves into. We got help. We managed to move on with our lives, and we're doing pretty good. And we're glad to be here for you if we can be in some way, in any way at all. You know, there's no shame in asking for help. But, you know, beyond, you know, just what I know from AA meetings and AA's 12-step programs and things like that, I'm wondering, how does a person who's not a family member but is a friend and is concerned, what do you do? How can you be supportive? What don't you do?
Well, Dennis, thanks for trying to provide that support for your friend. Shell, some advice on somebody in Dennis's situation. They want to help. What is a way they can help someone?
Well, yeah, I think, Dennis, the things you've done are just perfect. I mean, making it clear that you're there, conveying hope to the person, that's huge. The social isolation is really dangerous for people. And so other ways that you can encourage your friend to, you know, engage in, you know, things with other people. You know, clearly, you didn't mention if he is seeking any help from a therapist, as I mentioned earlier, a physician, somebody from the faith community, really helping him think about who can he, I'm assuming it's a he, but it may not be, you know, can talk to. So to explore that, we know that certainly job loss, money issues, the strain that can create in relationships will increase people's risk of suicide if there are other, you know, issues going on in their lives. So those are very, you know, real factors. So, you know, you've done, you know, what I would tell people to do. And so, you know, continuing to explore with your friend, you know, what are other things that they like to do? What can they do when they're, you know, starting to feel suicidal? If it's calling you, are there other people to call? Are there things they enjoy doing? There's actually this formal thing called a safety plan, which actually walks people through, you know, figuring out what triggers me, what helps me, who can I call, what are my other options kind of thing. So the more you can help your friend think about those things, that will be helpful. And of course, obviously addressing some of those underlying things, which maybe challenging as well in terms of, you know, getting a job and dealing with those money issues.
And Dennis, good luck to your friend. And Shell, thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Well, thank you very much for, you know, allowing people to hear about this. And, you know, I hope folks will go to the website and attend some of the events that are going on this month and next.
That's Shell Gross with Mental Health America of Wisconsin. We've got links to suicide prevention resources as we mark Suicide Prevention Awareness Week. You can find those links on the Central Time Facebook page.
Some news just announced, very exciting for morning game show fans. The Price is Right is coming to Wausau, sort of.
This was new to me. Now, I watched The Price is Right a lot back in the day,
me too.
So much lately, but there's a live touring view version of the show, the real deal. The one on TV is filmed in Los Angeles, but am I going to go to Los Angeles just to be on the show? That means no. But they take it on the road with a different host so you can live the Price is Right dream in a theater near you.
The show comes to the Grand Theater in Wausau in February. Tickets go on sale next week. After doing a bit of research, it looks like the show also came to Appleton earlier this year.
I think I would be pretty good on The Price is Right. I've got as you know, from my observation of cookie prices at local establishments, I have an eye for nuances and variations in the costs of humble things.
That's right, but maybe you'd only be familiar with the cheap products. Sorry
True.
To put a fine
no,
point on it.
Yep.
I mean, what about the more expensive products?
That
I don't know.
Might be harder. I'm frugal.
I think after watching the show for a lot of years growing up, I would bid $1. I would just keep bidding $1 every single
strategy.
Time.
It's a strategy. But then what if the next person goes with the two?
Well, some
then
people do that. Yeah, those people are annoying.
Well, we'll go out with some of the music from one of our favorite Price is Right bits here on Central Time.